Solution in Brotherton class today is Canto 1, Chapter 19, Text 7. Itivya vachitya sapandaveha.
Itivya vachitya sapandaveha.
Prayopavesham prativishnupadyam.
Prayopavesham prativishnupadyam.
Dado mukundam rimananya bhavo.
Dado mukundam rimananya bhavo.
Munivrato mukta samasta sangha.
Munivrato mukta samasta sangha.
Iti thus,
Vyavachidya,
having decided,
sa,
the king,
Pandaveya,
worthy descendant of the Pandavas,
Prayopavesham,
for fasting until death,
Prati, toward
Vishnupadyam, on the bank of the Ganges, emanating from the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu, Dado,
gave himself up,
Mukunda Angrim, unto the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, Ananya,
without deviation,
Bhava,
spirit,
Munivrata, with the vows of a sage,
Mukta,
liberated from,
Samasta,
all kinds of,
Sangha,
association. Translation. Thus the king, the worthy descendant of the Pandavas, decided once and for all and sat on the Ganges bank to fast until death and gave himself up to the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, who alone is able to award liberation. So, freeing himself from all kinds of associations and attachments, he accepted the vows of a sage. Please repeat. Thus the king, the worthy descendant of the Pandavas,
decided once and for all,
and sat on the Ganges bank,
to fast until death,
and give himself up to the lotus feet of Lord Krishna,
who alone is able to award liberation.
So, freeing himself from all kinds of associations and attachments, he accepted the vows of a sage. Purport. Now, before we read the purport, this is a very nice verse, because if you look at the Sanskrit, of course, you don't have the Sanskrit, but you have the English Sanskrit, which is what I'm looking at. And you look at the phrases in the English, many of them you can actually see them there. Some verses, the Sanskrit lettering is so complicated that you can't make out anything. It's like reading an unknown language. But sometimes the Sanskrit and the English correspond. So if you look, you can see phrases that I was reading in the translation, and you can see them in the Sanskrit transliteration as well. And we'll hear of them more in the purport. Because the Vedic tradition was such that when you give a class, you elaborate on the Sanskrit. Sanskrit's translated for us, but perhaps in another, in India, you wouldn't translate the Sanskrit because everyone speaks it in a previous time. And then you would go into each Sanskrit word and elaborate. It's like as if it's a sutra. verses like a sutra, and there's so much encapsulated within that particular verse. And as it comes up, it's like a bud, and it starts to come out, and it blossoms, and then it has fragrance. So this is the way, actually, of approaching the Srimad Bhagavatam, is to understand that all of these verses, there's so much in them. And sometimes, at least I speak for myself, I feel very frustrated that I cannot actually get the... I don't have the right code to open them. I don't have the right state of mind even to be interested in opening them. But as we proceed on through our lives, this is one of the gifts that is possible to receive, is more and more interest in the depth and the magnitude of the knowledge and the bhakti that is hidden, or not hidden, but is encapsulated within these verses. So Srila Prabhupada will help us. He explains that the water of the Ganges sanctifies all the three worlds, including the gods and the demigods, because it emanates from the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu. So what was the first thing we learned? Yes, the word Vishnupad, and what does Srila Prabhupada explain us about this? The words Vishnupad is meant to be is translated as the Ganges. Why is the Ganges called Vishnupad? She emanates from the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. Lord Krishna is the fountainhead of the principle of Vishnu Tattva. So Krishna is the fountainhead, the fountain. The fountain goes like this, right? There's like a, it's built somehow, a fountain. And the water comes out like this and goes down like that. And the water spreads everywhere. And it comes from one place and it goes like that. So Lord Krishna is the fountainhead of the principle of Vishnu Tattva. Can anyone explain what that means? The fountainhead of the principle? Wait, we have one genius here. We have to get all of the others to come up a bit. Thank you, Prabhu, for your help. Thank you very much. But some others have to also answer. Otherwise they won't make progress. The fountainhead of the principle of Vishnu Tattva. Okay, I'll look towards the men. Yes. Yes, Anirudha Prabhu. You must know.
Well, the dictionary definition of fountainhead is the source of everything.
The source of everything. So Lord Krishna is the source of everything, and he's also the source of principle of Vishnu Tattva. So for those who are new to the terminology, Tattva means, like, you could say, like a principle or a truth or an element. It's called Tattva. And so Vishnu, Lord Vishnu, we understand, appears in many forms and has many functions, and so many of the things that we understand are based on Lord Vishnu. Because he's the creator and the maintainer of the material world, which is where we live, in the material energy. And he's prominent here because of his function. But Krishna is the source of this Vishnu, all the different forms of Lord Vishnu. And therefore, shelter at his lotus feet can deliver one from all sins, including an offense committed by a king unto a brahmana. So here we know who the king is. Interesting that Srila Prabhupada doesn't say including one committed by the king, because we're talking about a particular king. So you could say including one committed by the king unto the brahmana. But he puts it into a more general sense, because he wants us to identify ourselves with the king. He doesn't want us just to hear, this is a story, once upon a time there was a king and he had three sons and they lived very happily thereafter. He wants us to get the principle of what it is that we're supposed to be learning. And what we're supposed to be learning is that we are like the king. Now, we could say, of course we're not like the king. The king is so great, and he's a king, and he has so much at his disposal, and he's pious, and we're not so pious, and on and on and on and on. And in those things, it's true, we are not like the king. But we're like the king in the sense that we can make a mistake. We can all make mistakes, and we all have made mistakes. And if we think that in this life I don't make many mistakes because I'm a very careful person, then we would have to say to such a person, if they were here with us, that you made a mistake by being here. Not here in the temple, but you made a mistake by being here in this world to begin with. Because this world is the place where everybody is sent who wishes to have their own kingdom. This is mine. This is mine. That's yours. And then this person next to me doesn't want to have a kingdom this big. They'd like a kingdom this big. And in order to have a kingdom this big, they're going to have to take a little bit of mine. And that means we're going to have a bit of a fight, because he or she is going to want mine, and I am going to actually don't mind expanding my area of influence as well. So in this struggle that goes on in life, on a little scale like ourselves, and on a big scale like kings, because kings have so much more facility, so they send their troops marching in this direction or that direction, and they see another king and they see he's growing in power. They're very strategic, and they see if he gets very powerful, that's going to be a problem over here, because he might influence him. If he influences him, that's going to be a problem over here. So his mind is working like this. And in some way or another, our minds are also working in the very same way. Even if our kingdom is only this body and our few clothes and possessions and whatever we have, we're looking all the time that no one should come and interfere with our management of our kingdom. And therefore, in doing like this, which is how the living entity or the souls in the material atmosphere, they're setting out on their life's journeys, there's always the risk of making a mistake, committing an offense. And the king here, of course, we understand too that this is a leela. A leela means that it's not just an ordinary person having an ordinary life, an ordinary good or bad day, an ordinary up or down. But this is an associate of Krishna, of Lord Vishnu, and he travels wherever Lord Krishna travels. His pastimes go on. His pastimes are taking place actually eternally. This pastime is taking place eternally. And we can say, well, that's confusing. And it is to us, because we have to take course of training, mental training, spiritual training, before we can enter into these deeper subjects of what is a pastime, as opposed to what is just kind of going on around me the way I think it is. So here the king, he didn't do anything very bad. It was an insult, that could be said definitely. When he took the dead snake, he was hungry. Have you ever been in line for prasadam and somebody has jutted in front of you with plate in hand and smile on their face as if they belong there, and that nobody noticed, and you're behind thinking, that's not fair. So, and sometimes maybe if you were just a little bit too hungry, you might sort of burst into flames and say to them, excuse me, you belong back there, this is my place. Right in front of me, like that. Well, the king was hungry and thirsty, and in a moment of passion like that, the sage who was meditating didn't respond, and he, with his bow, he picked up a dead snake and said, okay, here's your garlic. And he put the snake around his neck. And throughout the story, as you have already heard it, the acharyas say it was not a minor thing. He would have quickly apologized, and he certainly didn't intend to be so rude. But his son, who was hot onto this and who didn't actually have depth because he was immature, he was young. Immature means you don't yet have depth. So the boy saw this and he said, this is my father, and this king, whoever he is, has offended my father, and I'm going to show him a thing or two because I have all this tejas, all this power, and I'm going to punish him for doing this to my father. So he set about to do that. And when the king heard what had happened, he himself immediately took responsibility and said, yes, I've done a horrible thing, a terrible thing. And he said in the previous verses, now something is going to happen to me. Must be. Because I've done something, something bad will happen to me. But he didn't get frightened. He didn't get kind of paranoid or worried or think, but actually I didn't mean it. It should have been very bad what happens to me because I'm a nice person. He took it very deeply. He took it very, very deeply and accepted himself as having made an offense and waited to see how he was going to be dealt with. And so when he heard what the boy had done in retaliation, which is basically to kill him, to give him 7 days more before he was going to be dead, for a minor thing, he didn't look at it that way and say, that boy's got a lot of nerve, and he could have said, and you know what I am, I'm the king, and I have the power to counteract what he just did. I'll show him, stupid kid, and throw back a curse in exchange. He didn't do anything like that. He was very deep. He said, this must be the Lord's mercy. Let everybody be peaceful and let me accept this. And he thought to himself deep within, this is a great opportunity. Because even though I'm young and I'm at the time of life that is meant for kings to expand and get a massive power behind them, instead, now that this has taken place, I'm changing all my plans. I'm giving everything up. Now just think, I'm giving everything up. Prabhupada uses the words once and for all. He made a decision of giving it up because, one, it doesn't belong to me in the first place, and two, just at this crucial moment, we have got a dead microphone. We'll give it up as well. Do we have another one? So one thing he said was, I'll give it up, I'll give the whole kingdom up, I don't mind. And the other thing he said was that now it is time for me to deeply concentrate on what I always wanted. Thank you. He accepted this not as a negative. It's very important to understand that, because otherwise it's like a sad story. And there is a sadness to the story because all the kingdom were going to miss him greatly. But he had a son, and he left his son and his family and everyone. He didn't even take a long time kind of allocating everything and keeping his fingers in the pie. He just gave it, he trusted, he gave it up. He went to the bank of the Ganges with nothing. With nothing. He took nothing with him. And this is really astonishing, and this is why he could give it up. Because if you say, I'm going to give it up, but I just have to take my mobile phone, you go to the bank of the Ganges and the phone rings, excuse me please, hello, hello. You didn't give up anything. You just carried it in a little miniature form and you popped it in your pocket and you continued. So because you didn't give anything up, then Krishna doesn't do anything in reciprocation with you other than what you wanted, which was to carry a miniature form of your life with you everywhere. Because you genuinely, he genuinely, a king who committed an offense, genuinely wanted to now deeply become purified, he was willing to take this step. And he took the step, and when he took the step, how thoroughly Krishna reciprocated with him. Do you know, for years and years and years, Maharaj Parikit was the king. And he met so many people, and saintly people as well. He met so many people because he was a respected manager of the kingdom. And he would, of course, serve them and wash their feet, do so many things. But all the sages who he had ever met were sitting now with him at the end of his life. But there was one person he had never met before. And that was Sukadev Goswami, who comes in on the scene very soon. And when he walked in, all the sages he had ever met stood up and offered their homage to him. Because he was such a significant personality who was going to deliver the king of all his ignorance. And so he had not met this person when he was the king because he was too busy at that time. And this sage was extraordinary. He was so extraordinary he didn't even consider it necessary to wear any clothes. He didn't wear anything, he didn't do anything, he didn't see anything. He walked past women and he walked past men and he didn't see them as women and men. He just saw them as spiritual. Everything was spiritual for him. And even young girls, when he came by, they didn't even bother to cover themselves up because they knew he's like a child. Because they were bathing and he's like a child. You don't worry, a child is totally innocent. You see children, they wander in here and they go over there and they go over here and you just let them be. Unless they do some mischief. So his innocence was extraordinary. But it was only now that the king was about to meet him. His one little innocent child. So, we'll continue with the purport. Maharaj Parikit therefore decided to meditate upon the lotus feet of Lord Sri Krishna, who is Mukunda, or the giver of liberations of all descriptions. The giver of liberations of all description. That's an interesting phrase. You could just say he was the giver of liberation. Finished. But liberation of all description, what does that mean? What do you think? What does it signify to you?
Yes. There are five different liberations.
Yes. There are five different kinds of liberation. What else does it mean?
Man proposes, God disposes.
Man proposes and God disposes. Yes. Anything else? Yes.
Well, he could liberate Maharaj Parikshit from his offence, which they are.
Yes.
But he could also liberate him from the material entanglement.
Yes.
And liberate him from his
whole situation.
Conception of being a king.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is what I was thinking when I saw this term. Also, the other answers are also good, very good and true, is that he can liberate you from anything. Because maybe we're not ready for five kinds of liberations yet. We need to be liberated from a current problem of some sort. We need to be liberated from a kind of mentality or a struggle that we're having. We need some liberation there. So Krishna can liberate us from the little bondage or the deep bondage or this bondage in simple forms that we experience. Or he can actually liberate us from the whole of material life, from the whole thing, from the whole thing. Just imagine We can't. It's like if somebody was in prison, if they were imprisoned and they started to think it would be so nice if I had a bathroom attached to my prison cell. And all of a sudden the guard comes and says, we're putting you in a prison cell that has a bathroom attached. And then he thinks, wow, that's amazing. It would be so nice if I had some sunlight coming in the window, because this is a very dark prison cell. And so they say to him, we've got another prison cell available. Would you like it? It's got a lovely, shiny northern aspect, eastern aspect. And he says, wow, that's amazing. Okay, thank you. And he gets that. And he feels really happy with himself. And then he thinks, I need a bit of furniture in here. And then they come, the guard comes and says, look, we just found this bed and this table and chair. Would you like these? Wow, that's also amazing. This is really good. You know, it's like I've got this like touchstone or something. And he keeps enlarging and elaborating and improving and getting his prison cell up. And he's absorbed in it. Because each step is a step forward for him. Now I've got this facility and that facility and some pictures on the wall of Niagara Falls would be really nice. Because then I could just look at them and think, oh, it'd be so nice to go there one day. So he gets pictures on the wall and he gets everything else he wants. The food improves, the whole thing. And he gets a big gym thing so he could get in there and do some gym so he gets his body all healthy. But he's still in prison. He's still in prison. And so a sadhu or a sage looks at him and thinks, this is not very good. This kind of liberation from your frustrations or your lack of facility, it's good, it's better. On one level, but in another level, is it good at all? Because you're just enlarging your attachment to your prison cell. And then if somebody told him, okay, you've done so well, you were such an obedient and well-behaved person, now we'll let you out. Let me out? Let me out? You're going to ask me to leave? And he becomes full of fear. But now, if he was fortunate and worked for it, he could go and see Niagara Falls, he could go and go to the gym, he could do whatever he wants. But he doesn't have the right conception. His conception is that my prison is reality, and so improvement of that is everything for me. And this is a crude example, because we know that that poor fellow, when he gets out of jail, he has to go get a job, and he has to pay income tax, and he has to work like a rat. So the analogy falls down at that point. But Krishna is calling us all home, and he's telling us, I won't put you to work. I won't do this. I won't do that. All I want is your loving exchanges. And we say, oh, I'll have to think about that a little bit. Who are you again anyway? And he laughs. And then he explains again through the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam. He explains who he is. He explains his glories. He explains his qualities. He explains what it's like there. And once we have been educated, again, he asks. Just like we read Bhagavad Gita, we go through and he explains so many different processes explained in there for different kinds of people with different kinds of tastes. And then at the end, Srila Prabhupada says, he makes his own petition to us. Sarvadamam purichaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. You come to me, one, to me, come to me. And I will take care of everything. So we may think sometimes, well, I'm doing that, I come, but you know, some of the things that you said are included in the everything haven't come yet. Like my prison cell still isn't really refurnished, and I don't have a wife in my prison cell or a husband in my prison cell, and I don't have this and that and that and this. Well, this is where Maharaj Pariksit, once and for all, he decided that direction, forget the prison cell. So therefore, when we hear about him, something touches our hearts. And we feel like, that's amazing. I can't do it, of course, but it's so nice. And that sense that I can't do that, but it's nice, Krishna's really pleased when you get that feeling. And obviously, if you say, I can do it, and it's very nice, that's even higher still. But when we hear these pastimes, we hear about these personalities, they move our heart in the right way. Recently in Perth, my husband was saying in a class, he said that the Western idea, Western concept is that a person who had nothing, was just an ordinary old person on the street, and they worked very hard, and they got everything. They became the president of the United States, particularly in America. This is the ideal. This is what people look at. Yes, there's somebody who really made it. But he said, this is the Western concept. And the Indian concept, the Vedic concept, was that a person who has everything and gives it all up, that's a person who made it. So very interesting, because we're forced by our living within this particular era of Kali Yuga society to be being pushed towards this ideal. But we shouldn't forget this ideal. We should keep a part of our heart wishing and hoping and waiting for Krishna's blessings, even if they come as a result of our mistakes. So then Srila Prabhupada goes on to explain that the banks of the Ganges or the Jamuna give one a chance to remember the Lord continuously. Has anyone here had that experience? When you go to the bank of the Jamuna or the Ganga, it's very easy to remember Krishna there. Someone must have had that experience. Yes, yes. Myself also, even though I don't remember continuously, I think of other things as well. But there's a sanctified atmosphere on the banks of these sacred rivers, and they flow through this world for this purpose, to give that sanctification. And even though nowadays the Ganges is considered one of the most polluted rivers in the whole world because of the amount of effluent and waste and other things that are thrown into the Ganges, especially around towns in India, still the Ganges has this self-purifying power that even the scientists can't quite understand. They definitely don't want to attribute it to the fact that this water is sacred, water is sacred. But still they can't quite understand why it is. They talk about oxygen and this and that happens and this happens, and it's due to green something or other, the algae, and they go on and on in their own way. But actually these waters are sacred. And even if you don't understand their sacredness, by touching them and placing them on your head, you also become sanctified. Maharaj Parikshit freed himself from all sorts of material association and meditated upon the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, and that is the way of liberation. To be free from all material association. This is Prabhupada's definition of this term. Now, can anyone see where that is in the verse up here? Not you Sanskrit Hindi speakers, but those who are unfamiliar with the language. Can you see where it's talking about being freed from all kinds of association? Anyone? Let us hear the words. Yes. That's right. Mukta Samasta Sangha. All, Samasta is all, Sangha association, and Mukta to be liberated from, freed from, all kinds of association. So Prabhupada will translate this. To be free from all kinds of material association means to cease completely from committing any further sins. Wow, there's something to think about. To cease completely from committing any further sins. And to meditate upon the lotus feet of the Lord, Where is that? Meditating on the lotus feet of the Lord. Mukunda Angrim. Mukunda, upon the lotus feet of the Lord Angrim. Mukunda Angrim. Which is in the third line. To be free from, to meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord means to become free of the effects of previous sins. This is very interesting. To give up material association allows one to stop committing sinful activities. Because material association, in the association of materialistic people, there are no sins. Right? Nothing sinful. It's whatever you feel is okay. And whatever you do, it's okay. Anyway, we do that. So it's not a problem. So we don't worry. There's no such thing as material sins. And they work very hard to make you not feel guilty. This is just how the world is today. And it's cool. So. And then, to meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord, to make that meditation, it means that you become free of the past sins. I'm not doing these things now, and I must have done them in so many lifetimes to be here in this world anyway. So let that also be cleared, because that's also keeping me here in this prison cell. The conditions of the material world, where we all live, are so made that one has to commit sins, willingly or unwillingly. Has to commit sins. It's intricate, this world. We have to eat, we do this, we do that. So there's this is going on all the time. So you may say, well, do I have to stop living? And the answer is, no, you can't stop living. But you shouldn't commit conscious sins. You should try very hard to avoid them. But sins will be there because life, you step on ants all the time, you do so many things, it's a life for a life. It's complicated to live in this world. So Maharaj Parikit himself, he was recognized who was a sinless person and a pious king. He also became the victim of an offense, even though he was ever unwilling to commit such a mistake. So this is the mode in which we have to learn to live. To be unwilling to make offenses, unwilling to commit mistakes, and to accept that most likely we probably do it anyway. And then by meditating on Krishna, taking shelter of Krishna, praying to Krishna, he will assist us to clear whatever we have done or whatever we are trying to avoid doing. He was cursed also for this. He made unwilling sins and he was cursed. So we might think, I remember even reading these verses as a young devotee and thinking, gosh, Krishna's mean. He's so mean, you know, he was such a nice man. He didn't do anything wrong and then he made a few mistakes and boom, he got cursed. And oh, it's real scary, this kind of Krishna consciousness, you know, this Krishna kind of, you know, lets these things happen to nice people like me and others. And so it's not very, very nice. But now, with a little more maturity and a little more chanting and so on, you begin to look at it a little differently and see it more reasonably. So he was unwilling to commit a sin, a mistake. He made a mistake and he got cursed. But this reversal turned out to be the best thing that happened to him. Here is the secret of Krishna's mercy. The reversal, the shock, the disappointment, the horror, the pain, the misunderstandings, the difficulties that we have in this life can almost always turn out to be the most beneficial thing that happened to us. At that very moment, we may not know that. We may be fighting that like anything because we have our pre-concept of how things should have run. But at that very point, Krishna may be intruding on our life with a blessing and not a punishment. The principle is that one should not willingly commit any sin in his life and should constantly remember the lotus feet of the Lord without deviation. Or, let's modify this. Of course, we can't modify the Srimad Bhagavatam by changing the meaning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, but we can adjust this a little bit and say like this. To the degree that one is unwilling to commit sins and constantly remember the lotus feet of the Lord, to that degree, Krishna will give this result. The Bhagavatam will say, you must do this. And we will think sometimes, I can't do this. So then we can relativize it without changing the depth of the meaning that is being stated. Only in such a mood will the Lord help the devotee make regular progress to the path of liberation and thus attain the lotus feet of the Lord. And even if there are accidental sins committed by the devotee, the Lord saves the surrendered soul from all sins, as confirmed in all scriptures. So those who have been a parent, who are a parent, or those who have been well-parented themselves, will know that a well-managed parent or a very good teacher will push the student or the child in the direction that they are moving away from. If the child is very lazy, you push the child towards doing some hard work. And if the child is very industrious, perhaps works so hard, but has no time to do other important things, then you push the child to working less. And so one child or one student, you're pushing them this way, and the other one you're pushing them that way. And so if you take the wrong formula, if you say, okay, I understand, I see this, that means everything, then you make a mistake, because the expert teacher is not teaching everyone the same. And we had an interesting experience, because generally when we were young in your age, Srila Prabhupada was physically present with us. And his main push all the time was to distribute his books. This was primary. In the same way as an army, the main force is the fighting force. Otherwise there's no reason to call it an army. And all the other people participate in the fighting effort. But sometimes it goes to our head that, oh, I'm in the main force. Oh, I'm a bit better than everybody else. I know how to fight. I also know how to fight with my own army. Because, you know, they have to offer me the high position. They have to do this for me. This oftentimes happened. And the leading devotees, who were quite young, they weren't old and wise, they would go to their own heads a bit. And then the army would start fighting with itself. This way, fight this way, because it's much easier to fight with yourself than to fight with all those people out there who didn't take you very seriously. So this infighting would go on. And we found ourselves, we were not fighting people. We had a child, we had a family, we weren't in that kind of a mood. But Srila Prabhupada was trying to get us to engage in the whole fighting mood. Not as a book distributor, but to help with the mission. So we were in Fiji, and Srila Prabhupada had us in his room because he wanted us to come a little further closer, a little further forward. And there was one other devotee in the room who was a very fired-up sannyasi, who was really big, powerful, young man, and he was very strong-willed and strong-minded. And so Srila Prabhupada, he's sitting on one side looking scornfully at us, who's sitting like mice on the other side. And Srila Prabhupada said to him, so what is the spiritual master's order? And he very vehemently, he said, the spiritual master's order is to distribute his books. He was sort of looking down. And then Srila Prabhupada looked at him with great strength in his eyes. And he said, do you think that the spiritual master is a dumb stone? And he has only one order for everyone? And the sannyasi looked a bit shocked, because he definitely didn't expect to be spoken, responded to like that. He was expecting a kind of a cheer from the heavens. And Srila Prabhupada then turned to him and he said, one person he will ask them to distribute books, and another one he will ask to educate the children, and another one he will ask to manage a farm community. The spiritual master knows how to instruct every one of his disciples individually. And it was a moment of liberation for us, because we were under the thumb of somebody who really did think that there was only one instruction for everyone. And Srila Prabhupada thought about our situation very carefully, and then he directed us where he wanted us to go. But once we were directed, we had to follow. And there were enough austerities in following what he asked us to do, even though it was much easier than what others asked us to do. Because it's difficult to control your mind and say, okay, I'm just going to do this because this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And whether I like it or not, I develop this. So Krishna is like that also, like the perfect father. So he knows just how to put his devotees into the right situation so that they will want to surrender. So that they will want to surrender. And if it takes another bout and another smash, and another, if that's what it takes, he's ready to do that. And if one is more open than that, more able to say, please just let me know what you want me to do. I really now want to try and do that. Then Krishna will begin to guide you, and he will guide you more and more. And this is what actually, as devotees, we are meant to be practicing. This is Krishna consciousness, to be conscious of Krishna. And all the activities that go on to support a temple, to support the deity worship, to support the community, to increase the number of devotees, to distribute literature to the rest of the world, practically speaking, to manage this and manage that, they're all much lighter to carry if we understand the principle of what we're trying to do, which is simply to remember Krishna and to make an offering to him. And we all have this experience. We have some days that are like that, where things are simple and straightforward. And then we have lots and lots of times when our mind becomes confused, or it becomes like feeling like a great burden. Or we follow our mind wherever it takes us and we do something completely different. But Krishna is ever willing to help you again, to get things going, to get things in the right direction. And we seem to be ever willing to go off in this way or off in that way, and he's there again waiting. Go this way, this will work for you. So we should follow the mood and the intention of the king, a king and an offense. We should take this really to heart and take this as this is, I am a king and I make offenses. And so I want to follow the mood and the spirit of the king and find out, what did Krishna do for this person? You see, one of the most important things about Krishna consciousness is to continuously be finding the relevance of what you're doing to your life. If you continuously try to find the relevance of what you're doing to your life, your Krishna consciousness will remain very vibrant. And it will be strong enough that when you go outside the compound here, down the street and catch the tram and end up in the city, you won't become overwhelmed, whoosh, by the ocean of materialism. And this is a little island in the middle of an ocean, and you won't want to either run back here or go swimming in the ocean. But you'll remember, no, there's a continuity here. I have to keep myself focus, because I'm trying to do something here. And if you get off track, you bring yourself back very quickly by the same process. So we're all at different levels. Some of us are very young and new, And some of us are much older and wiser, and we've seen a lot, we've done a lot. Right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And we're still here, and we're still struggling away and trying to make our Krishna consciousness vital and grow. And those who are young sometimes are more enthusiastic because they're in the first phase. Sometimes they call that the honeymoon phase, right? And then it gets harder, and then you feel like, oh, this is too long, and so many things. But there are those who can help and encourage, and we should all team together and try to make sure the Prabhupada is satisfied by our offering to Shri Radhavallabha and Gauranitai and Jagannath Subhadra and Balaram. And this temple, I must say, is one of the most extraordinary temples in the whole world because of the amount of association Srila Prabhupada had with the Melbourne temple. And yesterday I was upstairs in Srila Prabhupada's room and I was musing on how it was almost like a result of an offense that the Melbourne temple is so strong, because there was one devotee, his name was Madhavisa, and he was in India, and he wasn't happy in India, and so Srila Prabhupada sent him to Melbourne. And he came to Melbourne, and he moved the temple. It used to be in St. Kilda. There's one double, two-story terrace house there. And he moved the temple and established this temple here in 1975. And it's only because he was American, and he had spent many years, actually, with Srila Prabhupada in the very beginning in San Francisco. And it was only because of the strength of his relationship with Srila Prabhupada that the Melbourne Temple became really solid, because he did everything knowing, having a history of experience with Prabhupada and an intimacy with Prabhupada that created the structure and the strength of this yatra. And Srila Prabhupada even came here more because he could draw him, because he was such a well-known person at that time. And here we are, and we're experiencing the heritage of that. So we are like links of chain, yes? And we want this chain to be so strong that it keeps going generation after generation, and that people well into the future will also experience the heritage of the Melbourne Temple through Srila Prabhupada's kindness to come here so often. And you can see the Melbourne Temple on more, there are more video clippings of the Melbourne Temple. It's up in the top ranks because there happened to be a photographer here. He was an eccentric fellow in the 1970s. His father was a video cameraman, and his wife was a hippie. He was a bit of a hippie himself. He wasn't even a devotee living in the temple. But Madhavisa would call him in and say, take photos of this, take photos of that. And so you can see Rathiatra, you can see so many things as a result of this person's service, and he never really ever became a devotee. So these are mysterious things that take the shape that Krishna wants them to take, and the shape that the devotees want as well. So coming here, my thought is immediately that we should all be very eager to preserve what Srila Prabhupada has established here in this temple. All right. Particularly where Maharaja Pritchett was about to give up his whole kingdom, but he made sure that everything went on very nicely through his son. So if anyone has any questions... Anything to share? I've stunned you all, huh? I've overloaded you. Sometimes when we hear about very grave things, all the kind of the level at which our questions are on become sort of overcome by a graver subject. Yes.
You could think about, you know, how you, if you're unwillingly
the material world is very intricate, but in our material life, even unwillingly, you know, we might be willing to do something wrong, but we know it is wrong and we still end up doing it. So how does
In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, Arjuna says something about this, interestingly, this tendency to sort of be unwilling to do something. We'll use this very simple, innocent example, but say, I see something on the table over there that's interesting to eat, and I'm full, I don't have any more room in my stomach, and I'm just minding my business, walking by, and I see this, and I think to myself, my gosh, that looks good. And so then my intelligence says, no, you don't need that, you're already full. But it just looks so good. And so I grab it after I've made all my determination and my unwillingness has been shown. My willingness overcomes my unwillingness and I take that, put it in my mouth and I feel very bloated with indigestion thereafter. And I say to myself, I'm not going to do that again. But I do. So what is this that forces us to act in ways that are unwise and ways that we don't want to act and even ways that implicate us? And Arjuna asked this question and Krishna explained this, that it is lust. And in terms of a Krishna conscious definition of lust means an overwhelming desire for something other than Krishna's service. An overwhelming desire. So it's very marginal when I became overwhelmed and when I let myself be willing. It's a very tricky kind of an area there. Because you can see yourself countless times a day determining that you'll do something and doing the opposite. If you're seriously trying to change, you'll see yourself saying, I'm going to do that, and you do this, I'm going to do that, and you do this. And if you observe, if you stop and observe yourself, you'll see this. And it's embarrassing, because it looks like I'm hopeless. But when we see ourselves doing things, the king, he felt repentant. He didn't get neurotic, he didn't get really depressed. He didn't stop his service from now on because I'm like this, I can't do service. But he felt repentant. And this is the balancing element when we get knocked over by our uncontrollable urges, is that we feel repentant, and the repentance tends to help us to try to balance again. Even when we get knocked over again, we balance again. And it gives us the determination to keep that endeavor going. So this is one thing, it's very important to feel sorry when you do something. And it's also very important, the example of lust being given, is that you put yourself as much as possible out of the range of doing that, if you can. So intelligence has to come in as well, otherwise we can just eat cake and feel sick and eat cake and feel sick and eat cake forever. But actually we have to also be trying to walk around the cake table or do something to improve as well. So repentance or remorse, when unfortunate that happens, and trying to use your intelligence to improve, those two elements will be there for somebody who's seriously trying to change a bad habit. Even if the habit doesn't appear to be changing very quickly, still those qualities need to be present. Does that help? Something to focus on when you feel, oh, here we go again. Yes, Jim.
I was just thinking about the word meditation.
Meditation. Well, I've got a very restless mind, so I don't consider myself a good example of a meditator, because generally meditation takes place for somebody who's sattvic. It means that their mind is quite calm, like a kind of a clear pool. And then, like, if you have a pool and you look in, you see your reflection. So they can reflect on things without any interruptions. But for me, my mind is full of, you know, like fish coming to the surface and rocks being thrown in. And so the water's like this, and meditation becomes difficult. But in, even so, my understanding, if you want to try to develop a meditation, is you have to focus on something a lot. Just like when I come here to see the deities, even though I live in another place and I don't see the deities every day, I do all sorts of other things. But from years and years of focusing here and there on the deities, when I come, quite quickly they come back to the foreground again. And so that's a very beginner's level of meditation, extremely beginning level. But I know there are people in service, who serve in different places, who focus on something and they meditate on that. And here, meditation on Krishna, you can say it means meditating on our service. And that's not so hard to do, because that's activity, you know, activity driven. But to meditate on Krishna so that you close your eyes and you actually see the form of the Lord, that's even higher. That's like meditating on the person who you're doing the service for, rather than only on the service itself, you're meditating on who you're doing it for. So that's recommended. And that, as I said, it takes a kind of like a bit of contemplation, and sometimes it takes a reversal to stop and meditate and start meditating on who I'm doing this all for. But it's not easy, and I really think that, and Prabhupada said this, I've heard recently on a tape, he said, some people think I'll leave this till the last years of my life. And it's very unadvisable, because you don't have a lifetime of practice. And it's hard to begin with, and you're going to start when you're getting feeble, you know, and the mind isn't so much under your control anymore. In the beginning of life, the mind isn't under your control because you have so much energy. And at the end of life, the mind isn't so much under your control because you're losing your energy. Right? Have you noticed? So therefore, when Prahlad Maharaj was, the boys were talking with Prahlad and he said to them, you should meditate on, remember the Lord. They said, Prahlad, we're little boys. How can little boys, you know, if there's no little boys in this room, but you bring a little boy in here like Dhruv and you see him running around and you ask him to meditate, you realize, oh, that's difficult. And then you take a 10-year-old and you see what they're interested in and you ask them to meditate, that's difficult. And a 15-year-old, very difficult, and so on. And then you realize that, hey, there's no time of life that this is going to get easier. So I must not put it off. I can't afford to put this off. And I can't afford to put it off at the end of my life because I'm just going to get another one. And I'm going to do that whole cycle again and again and again until common sense dictates that I should start right now. Right this moment. And you might say, oh, start right now, that's so hard. Or you might not say that, but I would say that. But it's not going to get easier. So there's where the relevance comes in. It's not going to get any easier. There's not a magic moment around the corner when Krishna consciousness is just going to be smooth sailing. Get real. You know, has it happened yet? No. Is it going to happen in the future? No. Because we're in the material world with our back to Krishna. So the thing is, I want to turn a little bit towards Krishna. And that's very personal. And each person can do that in their own way. There are devotional methods given to help. But I want to focus more on Krishna now. And if I can focus on Krishna and do all my services with the same force and intensity, that's ideal. But if some difficulty comes to me, it may be Krishna saying, now I want you to focus more on me. And I might turn out afterwards and say, oh, thank you so much. I couldn't have done that without a push from you. And old age is full of those things, isn't it? Especially when you hear of people you know very well and they're dying, you begin to realize, I'm on that list. And of course, young people are on the list as well. but particularly all the people who got their names at the top of the list. So that should make us thoughtful, and then that develops into a meditation. Now we're meditating on the material aspects of life in the material world.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation meaning a focused absorption. So let's try. And it's very difficult, but let's try anyway. Yes, Prabhu.
Well, is meditation very necessary in this age? Because it is meant for the
Meditation means what the activities of your mind are. And so you can say, that's not necessary for this age. But then I would ask you, what are you doing with your mind all day? What's going on inside? Right? We can regulate the outside. Everyone sees that. I can do this. But what do I do on the inside? And when you get to know people a little bit better, you see what they do on the inside. And then you usually find that they're very good at meditating. But they're meditating on this and that and that and this and this and that. And one problem is usually their meditation is spread out like this over so many subjects, especially like IT people, right? They have all these segments to their brain and they go... So you ask them to meditate and they say, no, I can't do that because I do meditate, but I meditate like this, like that. And are you asking me to bring all my attention to one subject? No, I can't do that. That's a modern man. He wants his brain spread out over hundreds and zillions of things, and if you can watch two movies at the same time, as well as playing music and as well as what are the other things that are being done. So his meditation is shallow everywhere. It's like in just pixelated everywhere, just one. And it's a great challenge to ask him, bring all that energy towards one point. And therefore we can say, oh, that can't be done. But you've got all your meditational energy spread out like that. If you don't do something with it, what's your next life going to be like? What kind of a big position of Buddha do you want to be with Lord Brahma? What do you want? So these are the questions we must ask ourselves. What do you want in this life? Do you want to achieve something? Is there anything? Maybe nothing? What will you get if you don't try and achieve anything? You'll get something. You'll still be within the material world. And sometimes we get a false sense of hope by saying, well, Krishna consciousness means that you just chant your 16 rounds every day and go back to Godhead at the end of this life. Finished. So all I need to do is chant my 16 rounds every day and everything else is taken care of for me. It doesn't really work quite like that. Because Prabhupada explains, not merely chanting words, there has to come this bhava, like the king had bhava. It was from the heart he was doing things. So meditation comes from the heart as well as from the head. Yes, meditation as a practice is not recommended in Kali Yuga, and we can see why. But meditation is going on all the time. It's the action of the mind. And if we can bring our mind towards Krishna and meditate more on Krishna than a zillion things, then we're very fortunate, even within this disturbing atmosphere that we live.
Would this meditation be focusing on chanting yourself by hearing the voices?
That's one very good place to start. Yeah.
So that's a start, but it is not the end.
It's not the end. You know, one time when I was a very young devotee, we met one sannyasi who was a little bit radical. He was a bit outspoken. He came to Hong Kong, and I was a young devotee, and I was struggling. And he said to me, I never heard anyone else say this, but I remembered it since 42 years, he said, you should ask yourself throughout the day, what am I doing, and why am I doing it, and who am I doing it for? And I thought, that's a lot to ask. But because he said it, he was so forceful. So he said to me, so what are you doing right now? I was like, I don't have to answer you. didn't want to get involved in it, too demanding. But I, what am I doing? And then I went quietly to myself. I didn't answer, but I said, I'm chanting my rounds. And then, and who are you doing it for? It's like, doing it for Srila Prabhupada. But the mood was terrible. Had the right answers, but the mood was terrible. And it was so shocking because right in that moment in exchange, I saw my mood. And it was anti-devotional. And it was a shock because I was doing the right thing for the right reason, so-called. And so then I realized that you do have to monitor yourself. You can't just say, okay, I've heard my japa, now the rest of the day is for me. The rest of the day is also for Krishna as well. Whether you live at home, whether you're a businessman, whether you're a teacher, whatever you are. And there's where the hardness lies, because we can become good at sadhana, but it can become a regularity for us, and we don't even think. It just goes on by itself, because we're attuned to doing that. But at what? Why am I doing it?
Is good sadhana would bring us to that stage?
No, not necessarily good sadhana, bad sadhana. There's no formula. We seek a formula because we're... Are you an IT person? On a formula, give me the formula, I'll take that home, put it into my computer, and I'll get that together. There's no formula because Krishna is Krishna, he's real. He's not interested in giving you formula, he's interested in your relating with him.
One comment only. As you said, Prahlad Maharaj was meditation, best example. And Swami Krishna, even though he was putting a snake around his neck, he's completely absorbed in meditation. He didn't know what he was doing.
He didn't know what he was doing. Maharaj Cricket. Yeah. Very mysterious. This is called a leela, that's why we say it's a leela. And when you ask questions like, well, how could somebody who is absorbed in meditation put a snake around somebody's neck? Then the answer is that these great personalities are under the energy of the Lord in such a way that they act however the Lord wants them to act. And the result of their behavior is extraordinary. It's not ordinary. So if we say, well, can I be like that? Can I, you know, excuse myself? No, we are not doing leela. And how do I know I'm not doing leela? Because I forget Krishna all the time. And I'm busy with my job, my family, my body, my. And they're not. So no, this is not got this. Take the pulse. Your life doesn't have the symptoms of a leela. I'm sorry. But theirs does. So we can learn from them. Thank you. All right, I've kept you all too long. Please excuse me.